I'm here.
Oh, okay. Hey.
Oh, okay. I'll get on mic.
Yeah, Jim.
I just have one question.
Yeah, go ahead.
Is it possible, and this is a whole show, is it possible for anybody to become president without lying? Is it possible for anybody to attain the position and the power that they have and be honest? How can they get elected and be honest?
So you're saying this is the United States of Lemmings?
Yes. I'm saying that I don't believe that politicians, good, bad, whatever they are, whoever they may be, I am so cynical.
Ah, oh, wait, maybe I know why. Because their projection to the masses who stupidly vote for their lies is in part enhanced by the behavior of the communicators, which is people like us, which is why I'm taking the risk of challenging my constituency to have a higher standard.
Do you remember when we had a WBAI programmer run for mayor of New York?
Jimmy Press?
No.
Oh, wait. Who?
Ruth
Messinger.
Messinger. Right.
Yes. Messinger. Ruth. That was her slave name, but everybody mispronounced it.
Yeah, right.
And they called her Messenger.
And she was an utterly honest, real person. And look how they smeared her. Look what happened to her.
Ah, but Jim, the purpose of voting is not to predict the winner, but to express your opinion.
I'm not complaining about the voters. I'm complaining about the two-party machine system in which I do not believe an honest person can attain power.
Well, that remains to be seen.
It does.
And I
pray I am wrong.
Yeah. And I'll bet you my chance to become president on that.
There you go. and mine. I'll throw mine in with you.
No, you're a great guy. This is Jim Freund, the mysticist, the early morning warlock. The host of
warlock means traitor.
Ah.
Warlock in Celtic.
Are you a word that rhymes with
witch? I'm sorry, word that... witch. I'm a fellow traveler witch.
I love you.
Non-practicing Jewish witch.
Let me put it this way. Jim, I know you are a person of knowledge.
Trivial, but fun, yes.
Well diverted.
But my I have proven over and over and over again that my political wisdom is utterly worthless.
Well,
other than I don't trust nobody.
Mostly mine wasn't, but a couple of people didn't like what I had to say. And I asked their indulgence because I'm passionate about this. I believe that a position with great power comes great responsibility. This is from the Book of the Spider. and I'm disappointed in how my skin and people's hope were left in the slag of a nuclear heap of war-making and environmental destruction under the administration of Barack Obama. And I know that the thing that gets ground down by the sand at the front of the prow. It's a hard row to hoe. But I have been so innervated and elevated by the brilliance of our listeners. And I apologize for those I argued with. Probably I was impatient a few times. But I didn't like a lot of words that didn't get to the point. And these are dangerous and alacritous times. Right now, clouds of radioactivity and generations of cancer are circulating this planet because of a foolishness that this big muddy wants to carry on. And, these things matter, not to you or me, but maybe to our children and others we don't even know. And to have such power and to abdicate it so immorally, I think is wrong. And I'll say that, and I'm going to take some flack. I don't care. Because, I'll be gone, you'll be gone, we'll be gone, they'll be gone, but the children will still be breathing that plutonium, that iodine, that cesium, and the radioactive chlorine and other things of various half-lives. And that ain't right, and the guy is saying put more of it on the line of risk. So I'm done with that. I just want to take this moment, which is technically your time,
to say that. It's WBAI time, thank you.
Our time, good times.
Although I do want to tell listeners, by the way, that I've got an interview coming up with Carol M. Schwiller, who turns 90 on Tuesday, and who, by the way, makes you and I look like optimists.
Oh, my God. We got no time to lose. So let me get the hell out of here. But I want to proudly announce that I'm honored to have someone of the quality of Jim Freund to fill in and substitute for me next week on Earthwatch, right?
Well, yeah, it's not so much a substitution as an insertion of a program, a new radio drama.
Ouch.
A new radio, yes, exactly, yeah, bend over. A new radio drama by Ellen Kushner, which is, it's about Passover in Poland, 400 years ago, and stars WBAI's own Timothy Jerome and Tova Feldshuh and Simon Jones from Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, and a cast. It's a fabulous cast, and we will be premiering it, thanks to Robert.
Well,
we'll have some.
We at BAI have a great tradition of original live dramatic and other kinds of performance.
Yes,
and, we're back to the future. This is our future, and Jim, I'm proud to be helpful with that.
Well, thank you, and likewise.
All right. This has been Earthwatch on Pacifica Radio for a Change. This is WBAI in New York. I'm Robert Knight. The email is rknight, R-K-N-I-G-H-T at WBAI.org. Or if you listen on the day side, 5 o'clock shadow, I forget what time it comes on. You can email at bshadow at WBAI.org.
4 o'clock, no. 6 o'clock, no. Somewhere in between.
Stay tuned for some excellent wit, literary wisdom with Hour of the Wolf.
With Carol M. Schwiller.
Merging soon here on your radio station. Thanks for supporting us.
In the troubled years that came before the deluge, some of them they knew pleasure, some of them knew pain, but for some of them it was only the moment that mattered. On the wild and crazy wings of youth, they went flying around in the rain, until their feathers, once so fine, were torn and tattered. In the end, they traded their tired wings for the resignation that living brings. They traded love's bright and fragile glow for the glitter and the rouge. In the moment, they were swept before the deluge. So let the music keep your spirits high. The buildings keep your children dry. The creation revealed its secrets by and by. By and by. When the light that's lost within us reaches the sky. Some of them, they were angry at the way that the earth was abused by those men who learned to forge beauty into power. And in trying to protect us from them, only became confused by the magnitude of the fury in the final hour. When the sand was gone and the time arrived, in the naked dawn only a few survived, in the tents to understand this thing, so simple and so huge. Thank you.
Good morning. This is Hour of the Wolf, a Saturday morning program dedicated... Oh, what am I saying? Saturday, Wednesday night, Thursday morning program dedicated to science fiction, fantasy, enchantment, and yes, the imagination. My name is Jim Freund. This morning, a special program, the first of several special programs, this one dedicated to Carol M. Schwiller. Stay tuned. April 12th, 1921. Carol M. Schwiller, whose writing I began paying attention to a little bit before, actually, her first collection came out. Her first collection was called Joy in Our Cause. I say, Join Our Cause. I had already read some of her short stories from Dangerous Visions and various of the science fiction magazines. She was very much at the forefront of what was called in science fiction the New Wave. This was the American New Wave. There have been several New Waves. But Margot Adler started Hour of the Wolf, 5 to 7 a.m. in 1971 or 72, we figured. I've got notes at home. But in 1973 is when Joy in Our Cause came out. And I have always followed the career and the writing of Carol. And Carol has been a regular guest on this program through the years. And thanks to an email from Gavin Grant, came out about, 3 months ago, and was sent to a bunch of people saying, y'all realize that Carol's going to be 90 in April, right? And I was like, I had no idea. Wow. Cool. So a few things about that. Number one is that next Tuesday we will be throwing her a birthday party, and I hope that you will attend. That will be at my usual venue for the New York Review of Science Fiction readings, the Soho Gallery of Visual Art at 138 Sullivan Street. Admission is free, but... And come and hear Carol be interviewed and read and feted? Is that a proper word? How would
yes.
you print it?
Yes. To be feted. Feted.
Okay, yeah. Feted but sounds negative.
With two E's, not an E and an I.
Yes,
that
exactly.
Would be
that
totally
would
wrong.
That would be very wrong. And Carol actually wanted to do this show tonight live. And it's like, you know what, Carol? Neither of us are kids anymore. So maybe it's better not to. So I went over to her house, to her apartment in Manhattan, yesterday afternoon, Wednesday afternoon. And, well, first I will play you 30 minutes of that interview, and then I will play you a reading that she did at one of the other reading series in New York. I should mention, by the way, I'll give you all the details on my event for her. There will also be one at Word, part of the Walt Newton reading series in Greenpoint, Brooklyn. I'll give you all that information before the show is over. I am going to do the awful, though. I am going to do a but first. And the but first is Robert was talking about what we're going to be doing with the time that he so generously gave so we could do a 3-hour time slot and premiere this fabulous radio drama. And so here is a promo for that radio drama.
The Witches of Lublin, Poland, 1797.
Ah, there you are, Rivka. Have you been playing music somewhere?
That's exactly what Rivka has been doing. And in 18th century Poland, a Jewish woman who plays music in front of men risks losing everything. When the powerful Count of Lublin takes an interest in her music, the price to be paid may be higher than Rivka has imagined. I'm Ellen Kushner. Join me for The Witches of Lublin, a holiday special starring Tova Feldshuh as Rivka, in a musical drama of a family that discovers that music and love have a power greater than all of them.
Yes, Robert. We're talking with Robert and saying, yes, that Tim Jerome who did the thing where Robert performed for WBAI. So he will be here next week.
Oh, man.
With the airtime that you've donated, along with Ellen Kushner, who wrote this radio drama. I mean, this is like an all-star cast. I don't know if you're...
He and they and the station let me speak on behalf of the station. I did my own little small version of Hull to... recreate all the little turns of phrase about the history of the station, as far as I know it. And
I do need that recording.
Yeah.
Actually, I wouldn't mind replaying it. Have you played it?
I'll give you a copy.
Give me a copy
before
next Wednesday so I can play it on the combined show.
Well, you got it. I mean, I was so proud to take part in something that...
So Tim will be here, and it would be very appropriate.
Something over Broadway whose first syllable is bull.
There you go. There you go. Good night, Robert.
Good night, everybody.
Oh, okay, but we'll hear from you if you get me that recording next week. We'll hear from you.
I'll leave it before I go right now.
Oh, great, great. Fabulous. Okay, so that's The Witches of Lublin, and thank you, Robert, for being incredibly generous. And for those who know the name Ellen Kushner, you know that this is not going to be just some old Jewish tale. This is a modern fantasy story that I think you will like no matter what cultural heritage you happen to beckon from. It is interesting and, by the way, timely for the holiday season, the April holiday season. Getting back to Carol M. Schwiller, okay? I think I did a reasonable introduction. This is just a chat. This is not an in-depth interview. So I will introduce her here. We talk a lot about her family. Her entire family is amazing. Her husband, Ed M. Schwiller, was one of not only an amazing experimental filmmaker, worked with people like Samuel R. Delaney and he was doing computer animation before anybody. In fact, some of the people who left New York and went out west to join Lucasfilms and eventually created what became Pixar using the RenderMan software and all that worked with Ed. But Ed wasn't just into animation. He was into so much more. Their daughter Susan co-wrote the movie Pollock, and she's a professional set designer for among other people, for Robert Altman. Peter M. Schwiller is a voiceover actor and author of two supernatural novels. Eve is a botanist, an ethnobotanist. I mean, it's just a fascinating family. So we're going to chat with Carol M. Schwiller shortly. Not shortly, now. Let's, you know, enough intro, Jim. Let's just get on with it. Let me start by saying it is the afternoon of April 6th in 2011, and I am at the apartment of Carol M. Schwiller, who we decided it was best for her not to do the radio show tonight live, because, you know, some people don't get a pass. Some people are told, no, you've got to be there and you've got to do the show live. But in 6 days, Carol's going to have a birthday. And for that reason, for that birthday, we'll say, okay, this time you get a pass. And in 6 days, you'll be 90.
Yep.
Wow. Now, I'm going to make this more of an evergreen conversation and not just talk about today and now, and of course the fact that we're having two literary events for you in the next week, including one on your birthday, on April 12th. But, well, actually, you know, I hadn't even really thought about it. Is there do you want to talk about writing? Do you want to talk about teaching writing? Do you want to talk about life? Your family?
Do I have to decide? Wait a sec.
Well, yeah, well, it's a question of, yeah, I mean, we're just conversing.
Yeah.
So, yeah, you don't have to decide. You have to think, well, what would be fun to talk about?
What do you want to say?
Yeah. Okay, I will lead it. We were listening to some of the readings that we might play, which people are going to listen to right after this. And in one of them, Ellen Datlow, or was it Gavin Grant? Somebody said that you were writing in 5 decades. At this point, it would technically be 6 decades. Now, the reason for that being, it's like in baseball. If somebody starts in baseball in 1969, and then but the next year in 1970, they will say that that person has played in 2 decades, the 60s and the 70s. So it doesn't mean that you've been doing, you know, it's a cheat. But they actually count it that way. But when did you publish your first story?
I believe it was 55.
55?
I think so.
Okay, so that makes it 7 decades in which you have been writing.
Oh, dear, that's scary, too.
Isn't it?
Yeah, right.
Yeah, so...
But the other thing about it is that I never really, this is going to sound bad, but I didn't really feel that I had time to write until my husband died.
Yeah.
And then I really had all the time I wanted.
Yeah. But then you went from turning out a book every couple of years to having something like 5 books in 3 years.
Not exactly.
Yeah.
No, it was hard all the time because I did a lot of helping him too, even though... he was in California for the last few years. He was in California, and I was here teaching here, and he was teaching in California. We would get together, but when we got together, did we work? No. We had our vacations.
You had your life.
We ran around into the mountains and camped and did all that kind of thing, and so I wasn't writing very much.
Yeah, so when you were vacationing, when you were with Ed, you weren't so much... working, because you as a writer, him as an artist. Some people imagine, you know, Georgia O'Keeffe and what was the name of the photographer hung out with, you know, their vacations in New Mexico would be her painting, him snapping.
Yeah, right.
So, but that was not your case.
We would get together for the summer and then we would just take off and mostly go camping and mostly do that kind of thing. And have fun, which we didn't do when we were living together. We did work, and I did an awful lot of helping him. Little things like rolling up the wires and all that kind of stuff. That kind of stuff. But I was helping him a lot, and that took a lot of time from my writing. And then when we were each one teaching here and one teaching out there, we got a lot more work done than we usually did when we were together. And then when we got together again, we just took off and had fun. And
yeah.
Most of the summer, a lot of the summer anyway. Yeah.
And what kind, now when you were, you also appeared in some of his films and modeled for him.
Oh, yeah.
There are a lot of cult magazines that have you on them.
Yeah, right. I think the first cover he did was me, but he was on it too.
he also?
He would do himself and he would do me because we were handy, and then he would do all the neighbors and the next door neighbors. The problem is that most people will bring me an old magazine cover and they'll say, "This is you, isn't it?" And I'll say, "No, that's our next door neighbor," or something like that. They don't recognize me. Well, he did try to make me different.
Yeah, I mean, that was...
He didn't want to have me all the time. But anyway, yeah, I did model a lot for him, right?
Going back to the writing and your writing, in those, I mean, it's not 70 years, but in the seven decades from which you started writing to now, when did you start teaching? When did you actually become an observer of writing?
I'll have to count back. But that was exactly, Ed got his first real job in California, and I got my first real job at NYU. And I'd never had a job, and he had never had a real job either, because he was just a freelance artist of various kinds all his life. And that's why we had this separate thing. He said, "You go ahead and..." Well, what he said was, "I hate California. And I'm going to go out there and I'll see what it's like being at CalArts. And I probably won't like it. So you take your job here and I'll be back in any minute because I don't like California." Well, of course, that turned out not to be true. And he loved California. And actually, when I went out there in the summertime, I did too.
So it was a change in heart. But your work was here.
Yeah, right. At my first teaching, it went right on. And I really, well, I was very shy and particularly shy about teaching. And I don't think I did a good job at the beginning, though people let me do it. And I finally learned after doing it 5 or 6 years, I finally learned how to be a good teacher. And then I liked it, but I still was a little scared. Boy, every time I went into the first class and saw all these new people, I was pretty scared. But I did get to like it a lot. And so I kept doing mine here, and he kept... loving it out there, and we just got together. And the other thing was that our vacations were staggered, and his spring vacation was, he would come here, and my spring vacation, I would go there. So we were with each other quite a bit, I'll bet, 6 months out of the year.
Oh, that's great.
We were together. So it doesn't, you know, you sound like just the summertime, but it was a lot more than the summertime.
So that actually worked out. So you each had your lives, and you could each spend... you could spend half of the year together, even if one was working 3 months.
Yeah, right. It was really, and Ed, of course, would get programs he had to do here, so he was here a lot more often than you'd think, and so we saw each other even more than what I'm talking about, probably more than 6 months.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Thinking a little bit about your teaching and all that, I guess my question is, and as an observer of literature through the years, and you were always avant-garde, you were always ahead of the curve when other writers were there. By the time your first collection of stories, Joy in Our Cause, came out, you were in Dangerous Visions, weren't you, or was it?
I guess so. I can't remember the dates of those, but I probably was in Dangerous Visions.
Yeah, and that is considered the title, and the concept of the book was not the old masters, not the classic science fiction. Dangerous Visions was a collection that sort of defined what would become the next 10 years and after of science fiction. Really was a landmark, a watermark in the literature, and you were a part of that.
Yeah.
So I'm wondering, in all the time that you have been doing it, especially as a teacher and as a writer, how have you seen the literature improve, degrade? Is it better now than it was? You've been teaching, and you're still teaching now.
Mm-hmm.
So obviously you have been observant of how people write. And the genre in general, because even though a lot of what you write is undefinable, you tend to think of yourself, if not writing for genre, you remarked to me the other day that genre people often get your stuff better.
That's right. Yeah. Well, especially when I did my time travel story, and it just floored everybody that was not a science fiction writer. Everybody in my entourage of writing groups and stuff like that didn't have any idea what that was. But even the two or three people that had a slight link to science fiction got it right away. But I think science fiction, I don't know if this is true or not, but I think it's getting better all the time. I don't know whether that's really true or not, because if I get a magazine sometimes, if I get one of the big magazines, sometimes there'll be maybe one or two stories that I really like a lot. And most of them I don't. And every now and then, an issue that I like everything. But I think that happens maybe more often now than it used to happen.
Mm-hmm.
Except right now I can't read it all, so I don't know what's happening.
Yeah. When you say things are better now, is it that the writing is better? Is it that the science, the concepts are better? What's better today? Is it that people aren't as closeted in one mold of science fiction, and that?
I think that things are a little more, which I like, a little more literary, quote unquote,
mm-hmm.
Than they used to be. And that it's amazing how many science fiction people now are teaching at universities.
Yeah.
And stuff like that. And I think it kind of shows in the writing.
I'm well aware that when I started doing the radio show, about the same time when Joy in Our Cause came out, I looked it up, by the way, it was 1973 mm-hmm. that it was first published. So the stories, because it's a collection of stories,
mm-hmm.
were coming out for a number of years. But when I took over Margot Adler's show, Hour of the Wolf, and Join Our Cause, and that was a wonderful year, I thought, because it's the same year that The Female Man came out and Dahlgren,
mm-hmm.
some really mm-hmm. wonderful literary works that were inconceivable in science fiction merely 10 years earlier. And what did I have? Oh, yes. At that time, science fiction was still very much a ghetto. And to explain it to the programmers at WBAI or whoever I was working with, it would not be uncommon for somebody who was reading a science fiction book on the subway to put a brown paper bag, you know, a different wrapper around it. It was not couth. It was not literature, even though there was a lot of good literature starting to come out at
yeah,
that point.
Yeah.
But today, it is recognized as that. Today, the New Yorker can be expected not to label things as speculative fiction or science fiction, but certainly be printing it. Writers like Karen Russell or whoever,
mm-hmm,
who
mm-hmm.
I don't think she's written anything that isn't science fiction. But, you know, they just don't put that appellation on her book because they want to sell her books that much more. But as my feeling is, as a literature, it has, you know, it hasn't totally left the pulp era, for which I am grateful.
Yeah, I think you're right about that, right?
But a lot of it has also become real, has become real writing.
And it's the good thing about it is it's stories. It's still stories.
Yeah.
And it's still what people read that kind of fiction for is still there. Yeah.
Although, do you feel that the kind of stories have changed? I mean, Kelly Link doesn't exactly write stories.
No, she's a whole other thing.
She's a whole other thing.
Yeah, right.
But what she's writing is absolutely speculative fiction.
Yeah.
It's, you know, and I don't know that I want to label it, but when I throw my lasso around literature and say, this is the stuff that is this genre, I will include her.
Mm-hmm.
And she will include herself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, she does. Yeah, no, I don't think, like, for a while, well, the new wave, that's what Kelly Link is.
Yeah.
And that's what I was.
A new wave, because that was a new wave in the 50s.
And then, and I went into that, and very much influenced by my husband's films at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And we would talk together all the time about, you know, about, well, actually about structure and how to structure something that didn't have a plot. And he was, since he didn't want to do a movie with a story, he wanted to do these musical patterns mm-hmm. in his stuff. And so I was very much influenced by him in that. And then, but I don't consider myself in that, in the new wave at all anymore. I consider that I went back to standard. I think it was partly all that teaching. You know, people have a hard time learning to plot. And I had learned to plot at the beginning, and then I learned to unplot through Ed and to structure in other ways. And then in my teaching, I started to go back to plot because all my students were having such a hard time with it, or at least a lot of them were. And I began to kind of be an example of plot for them. And besides that, now I think I really do like a story with a plot. To mm-hmm. it now, and I wouldn't want to do anything else right now. I wouldn't want to write the new wave anymore. I just, you know, went through that part, and now I want to do stories.
Yeah.
And so I've been doing that for quite some time.
What literature has helped influence your writing the most?
Oh.
And again, you don't have to name writers, but you can.
No, but the thing is, I always say, because this is what I go back to. This is what, if I don't know what to do and I'm stuck or whatever, I go back and back and back to Kafka.
Yes.
Every single time. The short stories, not the novels.
Yeah.
And
there's a lot between you and Kafka.
The Hunger Artist or something, I will go back to that one. And well, I hope there is, but I don't know if there really is. No, whenever I was ever stuck and didn't know what to do, I went to Kafka. But there are other, well, let me think again. For a while during my avant-garde period, I was reading, Latin American and French people,
mm-hmm.
Translations of sort of avant-garde-ish people. But, well, Kafka isn't, you know... even if I was working on a plot story, I would go back to Kafka.
Uh-huh.
Right. But you're thinking of present-day people. I mean,
no.
My colleagues.
No, I'm not.
Colleagues. Well...
I love to hear about colleagues and all that, but no, my question is actually intended for Kafka.
But you know, there is some of the...
I don't care if it's an old
Greek philosopher. Some of the stuff that I like the best doesn't influence me at all. For instance, Alice Munro. I like... Mm-hmm. She plays... literary jokes, and that's what I like about her. But she doesn't influence me whatsoever, mm-hmm. as far as I know, anyway. Let me think.
So that's more about appreciation than inspiration.
It's a different kind of writing, than I do, but I do like it. Not always, but I basically like her. And lots of people. Who am I thinking of? Well, anyway, I can't think of anybody right now.
But saying Kafka right out there is, you know, I think that's core.
That was always been my... I mean, whenever anybody asked me that question, I don't hesitate. I just say Kafka right off.
Yeah, and it says a lot right there.
Yeah.
Are there any other of the Czech fantasists? There are some that are lesser known, or even the concept of the golem. I just love the whole Czech fantasy.
Are those the things that Michael Kandel translates kind of stuff?
He does more Polish than
that's
Czech.
Right, Polish.
And which has its own wonderful
wealth. No, those are...
The problem is that Michael Kandel is sadly... I won't say a lone voice in the wilderness, but he is concentrating on an area that is lesser appreciated at this time, where the Czech fantasists are embraced and they all get translated. Michael has to, work and fight and get publishers to say, yes, these Polish writers are great. And, where he can say, yes, I know you've heard of Stanisław Lem, but there are all these others. And that's what Michael has largely been doing.
Yeah.
Now, I haven't spoken to Michael in a while, way too long, come to think of it. But Polish has been his primary focus.
Yeah, right. I remember now. Right, and I remember I read some of his translations, right?
Yeah, and they're good.
They're good.
They're good. I always love talking to him about what should we be reading that we've never heard of.
Yeah.
And there's tons of Asian fantasy stories and stuff that don't get translated. And sometimes for political reasons, because they might be very anti-West, and sometimes just because they're not appreciated. Nobody knows about it because it doesn't find its way out, or people think, oh, it's manga, or it's something like that. And manga gets its own fandom. All that weird.
Yeah.
To me, weird.
Right.
I probably just.
Yeah, that's what my grandchild is into.
Yeah.
If he reads it all, that's it.
It's manga.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right.
How do you feel about that? Do you think that's a good way to bring kids into reading?
Well, he's one of those people that did nothing but games, and you couldn't get him out.
Mm-hmm.
You couldn't get him out of his dark room. And
that's not uncommon today.
I know it is. All the kids...
I did that more in like my 20s. And I did get out a little, but I know the...
I come across
the addiction to games.
Yep. And that's what he is. And just to get him... reading anything, I think, is pretty good. And boy, my daughter has so much. This is my other daughter, my Eve one that you met.
Yes.
Trying to pull him out of that.
Well, Eve is the botanist.
Yeah.
And Susan, I know she co-wrote the movie Pollock.
Yeah.
But what else does she do?
Well, she is doing a lot. She did her own movie, too. And it went around to, what do you call it, I'm so old I can't think of any words, film thingies.
Film festivals, Sundance. Festivals. And
Well, she didn't get into Sundance, but she got some other things, and she did this film. And she did also put on several plays in L.A., and hired herself out for all sorts of things. And now she's, right now, things are slow for all those guys.
Mm-hmm.
She used to be able to get a set decorating job whenever she wanted. She was very sought after.
That's what I was thinking of.
Yeah, like, she did a lot of Robert Altman films. Which
cool.
She loved to do.
Because I'm a big Robert Altman fan.
Oh, boy,
and
me too.
Mentioning McCabe and Mrs. Miller, that's a Robert Altman
film. Yeah, me too, and she is too. And she did a lot of work for him, and that was great. But now there's very little work.
And
so she's just puttering around of all sorts of anything she can get.
Yeah.
So.
And as long as we're on the topic, your third progeny, Peter, a.k.a. Stoney.
Yeah, right.
Who I almost interviewed when The Host came out.
Oh, did you?
And I don't remember why it didn't happen. I actually had a fantasy at one point of doing an event with you, Ed, and Stoney.
Oh, wow. Wouldn't that have been...
That would have been wonderful. That would have been wonderful.
Well, Stoney and I had talked about doing things together, after Ed had died, doing things together.
Yeah. But,
and I know that he could really...
Coordinated monthly test of the broadcast stations of your area. If this had been an actual emergency, an official message would have followed the alert tone. This station serves the New York City area. This concludes this test of the emergency alert system.
So, bear with us, and we're going to deal with this as, soon as Tony, our ops person, can come in. Let's see. Megahertz subalert mode 1, menu week. Well, you know what? It isn't making noise anymore, so we are going to go back to the scheduled broadcast with Carol Emschwiller and trust that this has only been a test.
Also does voiceover work. He's a very accomplished.
And he would be performer. Yeah, that's what he when he can get a job, that's what he does.
Yeah. Right? Yeah.
One of the things he does.
But you know what you should do? You should get given everybody's talent. There should be like and maybe it's something we can talk about. There should be something like an Emschwiller family radio drama.
I don't know.
Because they can do it wherever they are. One can write. I mean, there's not a lot of set decoration to be done in radio, but they've all got the talent.
I don't know what you do with a botanist. I don't know.
She might be the inspiration. you take some of the stuff in botany and animal, whatever, and, there's all the aliens.
You're right.
You ever want.
You're right.
Can
there's
come
some,
right
there's
out
some
of
weird
botany.
Things going on out there.
There really are.
Yeah.
There really are. So
yeah.
I have little doubt that Eve could,
yeah, right.
could
I'm
actually
sure she
contribute.
Could come to think of it.
Yeah. And she knows the genre. She's grown up.
Yeah, she's grown up with it.
The
whole
absolutely.
Thing. Right.
And Ed, I mean, Ed, of course, was, you know, a pioneer movie maker, arguably one of the very first computer animators, if not mm-hmm. the
oh,
first.
Yeah, right.
You know, before
right.
Pixar or RenderMan, as it was first.
Right.
Lucas.
No, some of the Pixar people were at New York Tech, and that's
yeah.
where Ed, I mean, he knew some of those Pixar.
Oh. Ed Catmull, I think.
Oh, yeah, that's one, but Alvy Ray Smith.
Yes.
Another one. And
I'm a huge animation fan. And I know it's work.
Yeah.
But
right.
I'm a huge animation fan. Mm. And I love the Pixar work and the computer animation stuff. And I've watched countless documentaries. And I've heard Ed mentioned.
Oh, yeah.
In at least
yeah.
one. Uh-huh. In at least one documentary yeah. about Pixar that actually covered the birth of it all. And they
yeah.
said, well,
right.
before
the Pixar, they were at New York Tech.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, which is pretty much where it all started.
I guess so.
But Ed also did other science fiction projects here and there, if not as director or writer. Didn't he? He did some work on The Lathe of Heaven, didn't he? That PBS
oh,
project.
Oh, some funny, some little bitty. Stoney knows what that is because he helped him. Weird. Just. Not very much, but just effects or some spaceship flying through something or other,
yeah.
stuff like that. Little bitty.
Well, there's very little effects.
Yeah, right.
In that entire production, other than making the city of, I think it was Seattle or Portland.
There were a couple of things that
making
not
it look
much.
Like a future
yeah.
city.
And Stoney worked with Ed when he did those. Was with him, and he knows more. About how those things were made.
Yeah.
And I don't...
I just figured since we were talking all about the kids and all that,
yeah.
that we should just, you know, discuss the entire family and their and their relationship to the genre.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Because everybody, even Eve, to an extent, mm-hmm. has a connection.
Mm-hmm.
That's why I still think. I think maybe the idea of an M. Schwiller family project may not be out of the question. For radio or something. Mm-hmm. So everybody can record, even they don't even have to leave where they are.
Okay.
But that's future thinking.
Good.
So anything else specifically before next we're going to be hearing. Now, what story did we choose?
God Clown.
Okay.
That's one of my.
That's right.
One of the ones I like. Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
I don't like all my stories.
That's interesting, and that's a question I will bring up on Tuesday, or have Robert if Robert does the interview. Between the two of us, we will figure that out. But that's going to be. This was just a chat. A conversation with Carol M. Schwiller. And Tuesday we're going to do much more of the biographical stuff, and Robert will have questions as well. And you've worked together enough. So that will be fun. But thank you.
Oh, well, thank you.
And we'll be hearing the story shortly.
Okay, good.
And in fact, I won't procrastinate too much. We'll be hearing that short story in just a couple of moments. But I do want to tell you about this event that I was referring to, and then the other event, because it's really a two-part thing. What happened, as I said earlier, Gavin Grant had sent around an email alerting people to the fact that this was Carol M. Schwiller's 90th birthday. And he said, people ought to be doing something. And I was one of the first to raise my hands and said, I will hold a special event. On April 18th, a little bit later, Eric Rosenfield, who runs the Wold Newton reading series at Word, they don't call themselves Word Books, they're just Word, which is a happening place in Greenpoint, Brooklyn. They will do an event the following Monday. So on Carol's birthday, the advantages will have cake, they won't. So on Carol's birthday, we will have a reading. How much reading Carol can do is fairly limited because of macular degeneration. You heard her refer to it. But also we will have a lot of, well, happy birthday, because it's actually her birthday. And then in the second half, we will have an interview with Carol. And as I said, what you just heard was a chat, not an interview. We weren't really getting into things. Now, I have not yet decided whether I am conducting that interview or possibly Robert Freeman Wexler, himself a fine writer, and by the way, one of Carol's students, he'll be coming in from Ohio, and he will possibly conduct that interview. He's certainly going to be involved, and exactly how he and I have yet to work out. Carol may want me to do some reading. I would as soon get an actress or another performer, but Carol wants me, because I do, admittedly, understand the tone of most of her stories, and Carol can prime me and teach me the intonation that she wants, and she's very particular. So if that happens, I don't want to be on stage for the entire night. People are there to see Carol, not me. So then I would have Robert do the interview. Okay, so that's the current thinking. Of course, I have to talk to Robert about this. Carol and I are pretty good, but we have to get Robert to agree. Okay, so that's Carol's birthday, April 12th, this coming Tuesday at 7 p.m. at the Soho Gallery for Digital Art. Doors open at 6:30. Events will begin at 7, but you know it's going to start late and go late. Can't go too late because got to get Carol home sooner or later. But there will be cake and cider. Admission is free. But we will ask for donations, because otherwise I'm paying for all the goodies that will be there. And also, I need to make sure that Carol is properly escorted, not only to our event, but the event the following Monday. So Monday evening, April 18th at 7:30 p.m. at Word. And as I said, they don't actually call themselves Word Books. Then will be the Wold Newton reading series. And we're sort of co-producing Wold Newton, involved in mine. I'm involved in theirs, although I won't be able to attend theirs. But nevertheless, it is a cooperative effort between us. And, oh, by the way, at both events, Word will be selling the latest book from Nonstop Press, The Collected Stories of Carol M. Schwiller, Volume 1. And this is, you know, quite a feat. And by the way, with just this gorgeous, gorgeous cover, an illustration of Carol done in 1959 by Ed M. Schwiller, the original of which, by the way, will be on display at the Soho Gallery for Digital Art. Okay, so the first event next Tuesday will be Soho Gallery for Digital Art, 138 Sullivan Street between Prince and Houston. The one after that, I have a... here we are. Thank you. I was going to criticize them for something I would have been wrong about because I was saying I don't see their information here. Okay, Word is located at 126 Franklin Street in Brooklyn, in Greenpoint, Brooklyn. It's very north part of Brooklyn. It's practically southern Queens, northern Brooklyn. And that's on the 18th. Oh, and with... it's a birthday party, right? So not only will Carol be there, and I didn't even tell you what they're doing, but there will be a magician performing, Magic Brian, will perform, so appropriate for a birthday party. And after that, Matt Chaney, who is billed here as a science fiction scholar, and that is indeed true, will be conducting an interview with Carol there. Now, why both these interviews and the one I had tonight? It doesn't matter. It's fine. Because, and Margot and I are in this speech. Cool. Thank you, Robert. The interview, if I do it, is going to be sort of the James Lipton style of, I'll have a bibliography in front of me, and I'm going to say, okay, first you're writing these stories, then you'll be writing this book, and I'll simply go through her career and ask about each individual work on a very general biographical basis. If Robert does the interview, Robert was one of her students and has worked with her in various capacities, and that's more likely to be shop talk. And since Carol is such a brilliant teacher, that too will have its own imprimatur. And then Matt Chaney, when he conducts the interview, will clearly be doing the more literate, scholarly interview, and which, of course, she is up to because of her craft. And I am going to make sure, by the way, if I have to loan my equipment to Eric Rosenfield, who produces the Wold Newton series, and I probably will, we will make sure that we get this all recorded. And I will film mine, and Eric will film his. But, oh, yeah, there's a Carol M. Schwiller website, by the way. Google the Carol M. Schwiller Project. That's, and the spelling of her last name is E-M-S-H-W-I-L-L-E-R. Visit her webpage, take a look at the Wikipedia information, the science fiction database, internet science fiction database, bibliography. There's a lot of her stories online, but you know what? We have a story right here, performed at the third reading series in New York. And I mentioned Gavin Grant. Well, this is a piece that he was co-host of the series at that time with Ellen Batlow. Now, Matt Kressel, Gavin lives in Northampton. Matt lives in Brooklyn. It's a little closer. Matt Kressel has taken that place. But this goes back to, let's see, I recorded this on, yes, March 21st in 2007. So, shut up, Jim. Time to listen to Carol Reed.
Second reader is having a great time recently. She's published 5 books in the last 6 years. She recently received a World Fantasy Award for Life Achievement, and then she went on and published another book after that. She is one of the guests of honor at the World Fantasy Convention in Saratoga Springs in November this year. And she is the author, most recently, of a lovely novel, which I just read and loved, called The Secret City. And she is going to read from a story. She's going to read a story that is in one of Ellen and Terry's anthologies, The Coyote Road, which will be out in June, I believe.
July.
July 19th. So, ladies and gentlemen, Carol M. Schwiller.
Okay, this is called God Clown. Mudslides, landslides, earthquakes. We know what great God Clown does. Let's see, gotta get this right. We hear him laughing right in the middle of doing it. Sometimes he sounds just like a donkey. He loves the desert. We all do. It's an acquired taste, and we all acquired it. At first, the desert scared us, but now it's great God Clown that scares. Last year, crops dried up. All the grapes turned to raisins on the vine. This year, it's the opposite. Water runs right into the house, even though I dug a ditch in front of the door. Abby's house slid down, skidded right across the road, and it now sits on Ramsey's property. We propped it up so it didn't slant, and it's good as new, but Ramsey may not like it when he finds out it's at his place. It's in a grove of trees, a pretty spot, much nicer than where it used to be. The stream is nearby. I hope Ramsey lets it stay. We think something should have happened to Ramsey's place, but nothing did. It's not even lopsided. That's not fair. Abby is much nicer than Ramsey. She saves animals and hands out food to whoever or whatever needs it. I don't know how many cats she has, though only one dog. Even the dog loves cats. Abby'd save a bug. I've seen her pick up beetles and take them outside where they belong. I don't think she ever squashes anything. And she saved me. That was a long time ago. I didn't know she was that type when I came. I just went where I saw cats and the dog. I could tell the dog wouldn't hurt me. He's like Abby. Or maybe he knows the difference between a robber and a visitor. Except I was a robber. I came there to rob. Nobody was home, and I knew it. I'd walked all the way from Little Fork. It was a hot day. First, I stopped at the spigot in the front yard for a drink and to fill my water bottle. Then I knocked on the door and called, though I knew there was nobody home. I walked all around the house. I petted the dog. I petted the cats, some of them. I tried to count them, but I couldn't. I told them all I was going to steal was food and a drink. Then I broke a window and crawled in. I made myself a peanut butter sandwich. I was a kid, and that's what I liked best. Abby only had one good chair. I sat in it in the tiny living room, a cat on my lap, as I ate. Abby drove in her rickety pickup just as I was climbing back out. I heard her coming a long way off.
If I hadn't stopped to steal another piece of bread for later, I'd have made it out and away before she got back. All the donkeys with ear stripes and striped socks belong to Great God Clown. In the yard, there was just such a one. Also one goat, one sheep, and a nasty rooster. Great God C, just when you think all's well, he'll trip you up. I don't know what he wants, mostly to laugh at the way we try to eke out a living in among all these stones and on the slopes too steep for planting. He sends our terraces down whenever he feels like it. Abby didn't say a word when she saw me. I was stuck, one leg on one side of the windowsill and one leg on the other, bread in one fist and water bottle in the other. No wonder I fell out and squashed her marigolds. She looked at me hard and then turned around and grabbed two bundles of groceries, came over and handed them to me. Can you believe it? Me, with my bread and water bottle. And went back to the truck for more. We took them inside. The door had been unlocked all along. Now that I know her, I know she never locks anything. She went ahead and put things away. I could have run away right then, but I just stood there. Abby is a small, skinny person. Even back then, I was bigger than she is. And yet she scared me. I didn't dare move. Finally, after everything was put away, she turned and stared me up and down. I was dusty from the long walk. I hadn't even combed my hair when I left home 4 days ago. My top was my nightgown, tucked into my brother's worn-out work pants. But she knew I was a girl right away, though some along the way had called me boy and sunny. Her very first words to me were, "How'd you like a bath?" She didn't even ask me what my name was or tell me hers. I don't think she cares much about names. I'll bet she thinks, do ravens have names? Hummingbirds? Jackrabbits? And what about all these cats? And I suppose she didn't care what name I gave her. But names are useful. Afterwards, she told me hers was Abby. I've seen God Clown. I really have. I don't lie now that I've been with Abby. Lots of people do, though. Many say they've seen him but haven't. But you spend your life in the hills. You see things. He doesn't like to be seen. One of these days, I'll be washed over the side of a terrace myself or come down in a big sweep of scree or snow. Those are his favorite ways. I'll bet Abby's seen him. I'll bet more than once. And so I took a bath, and Abby gave me one of her loose men's shirts to wear. I was too big to fit her jeans or t-shirts. And while I took the bath, she washed out my nightgown and my brother's pants. After that, we went out and fed every creature for half a mile around. And after that, we fed ourselves. Even though I had a big sandwich, I was still hungry enough to eat lots of split pea soup. I slept on a pad on the floor in her living room and was happy for it. In fact, I slept better than I had since I left. I felt safe with Abby, even with the door unlocked. We didn't talk much until the next morning at breakfast. Actually, not so much even then. First, we went out for eggs and thanked the chickens, every single one. Then we sat down to scrambled eggs with cheese. So, she said, do you want to tell me how you got those bruises? I thought they didn't show much. And after all, it had been 4 days and most were where you couldn't see. Maybe she watched me as they took a bath. I wouldn't put it past her. I wouldn't put anything past her. I couldn't answer. Look here, she said, and lifted her t-shirt to show me her back. I had that same problem, but a long time ago. That's all over with. Maybe yours is, too. Even more, I couldn't answer. It was a black t-shirt and had a picture of mountains on the front, and under it, it said, "Get Lost." I wondered if she wore it to tell me what to do next. Now that I know her, I know she wouldn't say that. Yesterday she was wearing one that had a book, and under it was written, "Read slowly." In a way, I know she meant them both, though. Later on, I did get lost in the mountains, but on purpose. "Well," she said, "it's not that hard to guess. Your dad or who?" So then I said, "My dad's dead. So I guess it's gotta be a who." But that was all I could say. And Abby said, "I don't need to know. Besides, that's three towns back." I'd already told her I'd walked 4 days. Then she said, "Let's get to work." And so we did. And afterwards, we went to town and got me some jeans and t-shirts of my own. Abby said I'd already earned them with my work, and I could do more work tomorrow if I felt the need to earn more. I said I wanted boys' t-shirts because they had pockets. But I really wanted boys because they were boys. And I still did like wearing my brother's old worn-out work pants. I didn't have breasts yet, and I didn't want them. Back then, I thought maybe I'd be lucky, and that would never happen. I never did tell her who did it, all those bruises. I mean, it's not a unique story that has to be told over and over in slightly different ways and with different people. Abby'd be the first to say that, especially since she had whip marks on her back and wasn't about to ever tell me how she got them. Of course, there wasn't room for me to stay with Abby very long. All she has is one room with a sleeping alcove for herself. She didn't say anything. She never would. But I could tell it was hard for her. First, we built a house of thatch, all thatch, that we made for me out in the back of hers. And later, I moved way up above everybody else, onto the steep places where they bring their goats sometimes. Talk about a lopsided house. Mine was that way the minute we nailed it up. I was happy all the time here, every single minute, not like home. I did a lot of work for everybody, even Ramsey sometimes. I got me my own cat. I had me a sheltering boulder and a pretty good treat. I learned how to grow things, take care of animals, and avoid roosters. Not a one of us, including Abby, who wasn't afraid of them. And I did get breasts after a while, in spite of myself. But I don't like how things are going in our valley these days. Ramsey made Abby move back to her little spot that's a long ways from the stream. Not that she hasn't a pretty good ditch. He even tried to get her to pay rent for the 2 weeks she spent on his land before she could get her house dragged back. And now these last things. Rattlesnakes all over this year. People's dogs dead. Houses full of stink bugs. Ramsey being Ramsey-ish. Abby's too old for this kind of aggravation. Not that she would ever tell anybody how old she is. She says your age is in how hard it is to hop around, whether you can still repair the roof without falling off, and whether you can see the leaves at the tops of trees. And she says, I'm getting to that age. And this now is the last straw. My own house slid right on down, all the way down, in the middle of the night. That wouldn't be so bad if it hadn't landed on top of Abby's. She heard it coming, sprained her wrist rescuing her new puppy. It was hard enough for her getting around before, and now look. Her house is okay, but mine is a mess. We, Abby, even with her bad wrist and a couple of her neighbors, dragged it back up piece by piece and propped it against my boulder. But I spent the night with Abby. Helped her feed everything, helped her cook a stew. We thanked the vegetables. The very next morning, a hailstorm ruins everybody's gardens. Talk about last straws. This has got to stop. I said, Abby, we have to do something. Have things ever been this bad? And she says, this is the way it is. Sometimes worse and sometimes better. And I say, I don't think so. And yet another bad thing. Now the neighbors warned me that Ramsey found out where I used to live and told him I was here. My stepfather's going to come and get me once he gets the truck working. Wouldn't it be nice if Great God Clown would have something happen to the truck on the way here? Or all of a sudden too much water in the ford, or another mudslide, down by the forks. Sometimes I think to go on up to meet him. God clown, I mean. He's got to be pretty old by now, and maybe even meaner and more crotchety than ever. It sure seems so. Abby would go, I bet, if she still could. She'd take him a present. Food, most likely. Or a kitten. Though, what would he do with a kitten? Considering what's been happening, a rooster would be more fitting, and Abby's got a nasty one she could well do without. I'll do it. Bring gingerbread and the rooster. Enough lemonade for both of us. God clown and me, I mean. I won't tell Abby. She might worry. I take the hardest, least used path, the one that goes straight up. In spots, it's almost gone altogether. Trust him to have a path just exactly like this, all rocks and ruts. Some places I have to crawl. Some places are completely washed out. Where else would it lead except to him? I didn't bring enough food, so I eat some of the gingerbread. I drink half the lemonade and water it down from the stream. Maybe great God clown won't notice. It's still pretty good, even if weak. A couple of times I think I'm lost, but I always take the worst and least used trail. It's got to be the right way. It's afternoon before I get anywhere that seems like any place at all. A ledge and not much of a cave behind it, but all the more reason this has got to be his. My legs are shaky. I'm used to climbing, but not so far, so fast, and so steep. I flop down, but the ledge is kind of scary. Narrow and a drop-off on two sides. So I go into the cave. After all that sunshine, I can't see very well in here. Everything gleams of mica and fool's gold. All things with glitter and with stripes or spots belong to great God Clown. Also horned toads, owls that shriek in the middle of the night, sidewinders because of how they move. There's just about room in here for three or four friendly people to lie down. I sit. I treat myself to more of his lemonade. I think of what to say. Pretty soon I can see a little better. His glinting eyes, just like the fool's gold. He has a permanent smile, like a clown has. Well, of course he does. I knew he'd look odd, but I didn't think he'd look like this. A little the color of granite, a little the color of a rooster, and much smaller than I thought. I thought he'd have to be big to do all the things he does. Of course, I could probably start a landslide by myself. Even Abby could. You're an old man. How do you do it? All these disasters. And you look as if you need your sleep. I don't scold. After I get a good look at him, well, not that good a look. I realize scolding isn't what's needed. You don't do it for fun, do you? Even though you smile, even though you laugh. This place is so hard to find. You let me find you, didn't you? That sounds like a maybe. Then I think about how Abby has never said a single word against him, no matter what happened. I tell him everything I practiced up to say. I tell him Ramsey has four big dogs that roam all over and scare people. I say Ramsey has a house bigger than he needs for just one messy man. I tell him Ramsey found out where I used to live and told them I was here and I may have to go back home. I say Ramsey still thinks I'm a boy, even though I have breasts. I guess he never looks at me closely and never wonders why I never grow up from being a boy. Great God Clown doesn't answer anything a rooster wouldn't have answered. Then I ask him, just as if I had three wishes, though of course I don't. I say, number one, I wish that Abby should have the life she deserves. Doesn't he know her by now? Doesn't he care? Number two, there's me. I don't want to have to go back where I got beat up just about once a week, no matter what I did. There's no number three. I say, maybe I can work out some tit for tat. I can bring you things. I can help. there's thunder and a sprinkling of rain outside, but it doesn't bother us. The sun is still shining, low, coming in under the clouds. If I tip my head sideways, I can see a little bit of a rainbow. Great God, Clown is quiet for so long, I know something's going to happen. There's just too much silence for too long a time. Then he says, "You do it." "What?" You do it. But no cruelty, just what's needed. There's no going back, you know, you can't. I guess somebody has to do it. It's a necessity. Just keep things the way they have to be. The mountain trickling down, trees blowing over, boulders crashing off cliffs, sometimes right on top of things, on people. Has to be. Great God Clown is just like Abby. He says exactly what she always says. This is the way it is. Sometimes worse, sometimes better. I see now how it's all inevitable. Slides and such, hail, droughts, everything is exactly as it's supposed to be. I say, it'll be a hard job. That's the way it is. All the lemonade is gone by now, and most of the gingerbread, he liked it. But he tells me I won't need much. He says, there's moss and miner's lettuce, Solomon's seal, elderberries this time of year. They're good just plain. You'll have the weather to keep you company and stars. I'll do the best I can. He's hopping to the front of his cave, cawing, cackling, quack, quack, quack. Off he goes, happy as could be. I can't imagine where could he go? I yell out thanks for me not having to go home. At least I got that wish. Actually, I never did get a good look at him. The rooster was always in the way, and the fool's gold glittered so. Mostly I was watching the clouds outside his doorway, backlit by lightning. I saw the rain stop. I saw the rainbow over the top of a mountain. I saw a hawk fly by. There's no such thing as luck or hope. Things are as they have to be. There's nothing but great God clowns sitting up here deciding who gets what, all the way down to marmots and spiders. So now it's me having to do what has to be done to keep it like it is. You can't be mean about it. You have to be spry and clever and sly and quick. You have to smile. Have to. It's the main thing. It's all one big joke. Then I have a coda here that I didn't send to Ellen. I think I'll read it. Anyway, it's a tiny little thing that I had thought when I sent it to you. I thought it didn't fit, but I'll read it. Let's see if it fits. I sneak back once in a while, and funny thing, I think I see him right in Abby's yard. She's put out a lawn chair, and there he sits in a big floppy hat. Or somebody just like him. Imagine that. Opposites, two sides of the same thing. I should have known. Because she never said a word against him.
Carol M. Schwiller, the fabulous, the wonderful Carol M. Schwiller, reading at the KGB Fantastic Fiction Series on March 21st, 2007. And again, happy birthday, Carol, on Tuesday. She is going to be 90 years old, or as some people like to say, 90 years young, but I always thought that was a little cloying, but she will be 90 years of age, and that is just so cool, especially when you meet her, and you realize that this is a vibrant, amazing woman who hopefully we'll get past some of the immediate issues, and we'll get back to her writing. She and I talked about that at length today, before and after the interview you heard just now. And again, let me mention that this coming Tuesday, on her birthday, we will be holding an event When I say we, that is the New York Review of Science Fiction Reading Series, which is loosely affiliated with the magazine New York Review of Science Fiction. But this was very, very much, actually, this event is affiliated with the magazine because of the founder of the magazine, David G. Hartwell, you know, was very intent on having this happen. And he and I were talking about it. Very sadly, David has to be out of town for that event. But I hope you listening may very well be in town. And if so, I hope that you will come this coming Tuesday at the Soho Gallery for Digital Art, 138 Sullivan Street. That's on Sullivan Street between Prince and Houston. The event begins at 7, but you should all show up early so that you get an opportunity to meet Carol and say hi. And admission is free. I will be asking for donations to help offset the cost of a car service for Carol and the cake that I'm buying, a nice big cake, a special one for her and one for everybody. And there'll be cider and stuff. And we will have a reading, which Carol will certainly be reading part of. And we're going to work out how the rest will occur and an interview. So please, please, please show up. Carol is not as world famous as some of the other women who pioneered feminist science fiction the way that Carol did. You know, Ursula K. Le Guin, Joanna Russ. By the way, Kit Reed is going to be reading later this month at the KGB Fantastic Fiction Series. And she also, you know, is one of these wonderful, wonderful writers. And so on and so forth. And Kit, like Carol, these are not, when I say household names, I don't mean they're unknown. They're obviously very well known within their circles. But what? But they are not, you know, in the bestseller shelf. Or anything like that. Not like, you know, we had Lev Grossman reading last night, as a matter of fact. And yes, he is in the bestseller shelves. And we'll be broadcasting that at some point. Speaking of which, so next week on this program, I will be on from midnight until 3. Robert Knight has very graciously given us airtime so that we can premiere a new radio drama by Ellen Kushner called The Witches of Lublin. And Timothy Jerome from that radio drama will be here along with Ellen. And thank you, Robert Knight. That will start at midnight. And I will be here till 3, and Kushner and I will figure out all the details. And if you don't know Ellen Kushner's work, go to her website, Sound, and check out her NPR radio show, Sound and Spirit. I think you can listen to some episodes online. So, what can I say other than thank you? Thank you all for listening. Oh my God, yes, my time is indeed up. So I really ought to just be playing my outro. Thank you again for listening. This has been Hour of the Wolf. My name is Jim Freund. I will be back next week starting at midnight. Tune in. Sailing
It's been said that if you do what you've always done, you're going to get what you've always got. Here's a chance to learn new ways to be with people and be with yourself as well. This is Armand DeMille. Tune into The Positive Mind, Tuesdays and most Wednesdays, here on WBAI 99.5 FM. Tuesdays and most Wednesdays, WBAI. It's knowledge from the heart, my friends.
The little two-year-old yodeling cowboy, Charles Edward. Honey, say good morning to all the little boys and girls.
On Sunday, April 10th at 11 p.m., Sugar and My Bowl will feature bassist, composer, and former yodeling cowboy, Charlie Hayden. That's Sunday, April 10th at 11 p.m., right here on WBAI New York, 99.5 FM.
Like many of you, like many Americans, I have felt frustrated and betrayed by the state of the mainstream media in this country, a media whose priorities seem out of step with their responsibilities. We need a media that strengthens democracy, not a media that strengthens the government. We need a media that enriches public discourse, not one that enriches corporations.
Hi, I'm Jane Fonda, and this is WBAI, listener-supported, non-commercial radio in New York.
People's Station, out of system.
Burn it.
Revolutionary War is a necessary road to real liberation. Could we really win?
Right here at 99.5, List Alive. You're in tune to radio station WBAI 99.5 FM, New York, WBAI.org. Yeah.
Third World was in town. They didn't come up to BAI. They didn't come to WSB. Shame on Third World. Shame on Third World. Bunny Rugs, shame on you, Bunny Rugs. Got Core, shame on you. You don't come to Saturdays apart to WSB. That's all right. So we do it. 99.5 WBAI, you don't come. The Burn Baby Burn. Why? Who gives a damn? The revolution continues right here where we burn the American flag to ashes. Yep.
Got the fake patois. Keres One did a fake patois. Miss Clue got a fake patois. Even Jay-Z did a fake patois. Bad Brains had a fake patois. My man Snow had a fake patois. Even Jim Carrey fuck with the patois. So you know we come through with the fake patois. Patois got the fake patois. We come through with the fake patois. Patois, patois, patois. Fake, patois. What you know about Sean Bridgemont? What you know about Sean Bridgemont? First Jamaican in a Kentucky Derby. First Jamaican in a Kentucky Derby. What you know about Sean Bridgemont? What you know about Sean Bridgemont? First Jamaican in a Kentucky Derby. First Jamaican in a Kentucky Derby.
Yeah, nah, go and speak patois. Make one talk that fake patois. Everyone I listen to fake patois. Snow from Toronto, fake patois. Original root boy, original root boy. Shabba ranks, Cutty ranks. Your MO is mo, me say no tanks. Shabba ranks, Cutty ranks. Your MO is mo. Yeah, me right near the beach, right near my reach is the fire for the streets. Yeah. And now me can't read. Bald head teeth in me book. And now me can't speak. Yeah, fake patois. This fake patois. Fake patois.
Alexander had a fake patois. Even buzz around kinda sound patois. Maybe just enjoy, make a look patois. When he speak, he just speak, but to me patois. No way he did do the patois with the leaders of the new politics with brown brows. What you know about Sean Bridgemont? What you know about Sean Bridgemont? First Jamaican in the Kentucky Derby. First Jamaican in the Kentucky Derby. First Jamaican in the Kentucky Derby. Fake patois, fake patois.
Yeah, the boy a murderer. Here come the upstepper with fire on ya. Yeah, when I play games, this fake patois. When I take names, if the feds test me, go on, take aim. Crunch like Nestle. Snipe from the plains. Snipe like Wesley. Punch like Hawaiian. Snipe from the plains. Yeah, we shoot while we're flying. Murder Shiro like Chaka. Demis and Pliers. More fire, more fire, more fire. This fake patois. This fake patois.
Them fear. She not look at the big of me foot, me shoot beside them fear. Me can read cause them see me book, but me still come with them fear. Me not look at the big of me foot, but me shoot beside them fear. Them fear, them fear. She not look at the big of me foot, me shoot beside them fear. Me can read cause them see me book, but me come with them fear. She not look at the big of me foot, me shoot beside them fear. Them fear.